Welcome to the Superintendent's Hangout, where we discuss topics in education, charter schools, life in general, and not necessarily in that order. I'm your host, Dr. Sharetta. Come on in and hang out. Welcome to Season 2 of the Superintendent's Hangout. I'm very grateful to everyone who made Season 1 such a success. We had 50 episodes in season one, and now we're headed into and still going strong in season two. I'd like to thank a number of folks who are instrumental in this podcast's success. My daughter Maya for helping with editing, and she is a podcaster in her own right. Brad Bacchial for also assisting with editing and production. Tina Royster for helping with scheduling of guests and recruiting of guests. And to all of the listeners, thank you for helping this podcast grow and keeping the conversation going. In this episode, I sat down for a conversation with a dear friend of mine, John Detra. John and I go way back. Our children went to school together. We served on a board as co-chairs for a little bit. And John and I cover a wide range of topics from his foray into dance, his karate pursuits, his adventures in engineering, especially at the dawn of the internet age, the dot-com era, his several decades of work and growth at Qualcomm, and much, much more. I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did making it happen with John Detra. Welcome, John. Thanks for coming this afternoon, especially on a Friday afternoon, to hang out for a little bit. I was wondering if you could start off by telling us what your origin story is, where you come from, who you are, what experiences along the way have led up to this moment today as you sit in the office here looking a lot like John Voight. That's an inside joke. Wait till you see John's photo in the podcast. You'll know what I'm talking about. But in all seriousness, who are you? Where do you come from?
Well, it's good to be here, Dave. It's been a pleasure. And so I come from Madison, Wisconsin. Kind of spent my first 30 years in Madison, basically on the east side. Spent 12 years in college, 6 in undergrad and 6 in graduate school, and then moved to San Diego from Madison. So basically, I was kind of a, the good kid. Did really well elementary, and then when the parents get a divorce, kind of like triggers this big transition. And that's the same with me when I was about 11 years old, kind of like in middle school, and basically kind of got edgy and wanted to do everything. Wanted to be the good kid, wanted to be the bad kid, wanted to be the athletic kid, wanted to be the, everything else in between. And so basically, I did really well in school up until junior year, where things kind of caught up to me. And one semester, I think that first semester, I got a B in math. And I thought the world was going to end. And, I was living with my mom. And then I just said, hey, I got to move back to dad. He's going to, he was kind of a control freak. And I know it was kind of like straight and narrow, and kind of like basically at that point too, I'd started a karate club. I was in sports. I did football for 2 years, basketball, tennis, golf. And, I decided, hey, I want to do karate, some martial art. And there were a couple of gyms in the, city. But they were kind of edgy, had some drugs and different kinds of things. And I found this flyer with a university sports club. It was JKA Karate. And I'm like, oh, go up to the university and kind of checked it out. And really, really fell in love. And really, that was kind of like one of the things that saved me, because it kind of like introduced me to college and the university scene. Got to meet a bunch of graduate students. And at that point in my life, I found that most of my friends were 3 or 4 or 6 years older than mine. I was always the youngest guy in every group. And it was just a real learning experience. And I really, you know, it really helped me through college. So then when I graduated, I went to university and my dad didn't pay for my school. So I had to kind of figure it out. I had a lot of loans and grants, but found a job as a technician. And basically there was about 5 or 10 physics grad students in the club. And they said, hey, why don't you come on and see if we can get you a technician job in a research lab. And so it was a plasma physics lab. And I had a job. It was great. And so I worked kind of half time. And that kind of got me through school. And that's why it took me 6 years to get through.
I was going to ask you. I didn't know if you got multiple bachelor's degrees or you just took the circuitous route.
No, I had to work. And I also, you know, after I did karate for probably about 4 years up until sophomore in college, I kind of got disenchanted with the politics and the karate club. And it was always like, who was getting a black belt and who wasn't? And I had a black belt, but I didn't like how other people weren't or were. And so I said, I need to get a break. And so a lot of people had, you know, were in dance and they transitioned to karate and they said, hey, why don't you give dance a try? And so when I was a sophomore, I said, okay, I'll see if I can do dance. And let me tell you, as a male trying to do dance as a sophomore in college, it's not pretty. And so it was a big transition, but it was humbling and really learned a lot and kind of also met some amazing people and kind of locked into a dance troupe. And so I had this multiple-headed life where I was doing this high tech, you know, as a technician. I was going through electrical engineering and I was also dancing in a troupe and doing performances. And so I really love this lifestyle of kind of being exposed to different things. And then, you know, I basically got into graduate school and still dancing. And that technician job really served me well. I basically got a full research assistantship. My Professor Beyer, who I have to say, may rest in peace. He just passed away a couple of weeks ago. Amazing professor. He was like, I didn't know what I was going to do to go into graduate school. But he's like, oh no, you've got this great experience. We need you in the lab. We want people with hands-on experience. And boy, he was a mentor, just a wonderful guy, just an amazing human being. Just really learned a lot from him. And he really had a lot of trust in me. And it was kind of tough towards the end, because as I was going through graduate school, it was like, okay, you know, I really wasn't, the research didn't really turn me on. I was always better in teams and working with people and learning things together. And my research project was an individual isolated project that I was working on my own and just didn't, you know, kind of carry through. And it wasn't something I really wanted to do. I wasn't into writing grants and finishing up. So I had my dissertation already. All I had to do was write up this simulation program, kind of finish the dissertation. But, you know, some personal things, some love life issues. And
so that would have been a doctorate?
That would have been a doctorate, mm-hmm. Yeah. So I had a master's.
So you basically, it was like the ABD, all but dissertation piece,
all
right?
All but dissertation, mm-hmm. Yeah. And then at that point, since my research assistant kind of like run out at the fifth year, I was already teaching at a technical college. I had about like a full year of teaching math and computers. And I was also working at a pretty high-end restaurant. Mm-hmm. So I was bringing in some nice tips. So I was living okay. And I was like, okay, maybe I'll just move down to Chicago and take this life. It's great and, you know, see what life brings me. But before I, you know, kind of finalized that decision, a couple of people from my research group kind of gave me a call, Joe Burke and Jim Thompson. And they said, hey, Qualcomm is this new company in San Diego. Why don't you at least come down and interview and see what you think? So I had two interviews for engineering jobs. One was Motorola. That didn't really work out. That was probably a year earlier. And then I did this one. So it wasn't like I was really into it. But it was an amazing experience. It was a two-day interview. I interviewed with a bunch of people. Some of them went well. Some of them didn't. And this one guy kind of decided, yeah, we could use you. Because at that point, I had stepped outside the ladder of technology careers because, you know, my master's was in 86. This was 92. I was like, well, what are you going to do? My bachelor's was in 86, and it was like 89, I think, was when my master's was like, what have you done for the last 3 or 4 right. years? And so basically, you know, they took a chance on me, and I just joined a trial, basically a CDMA technology trial team, and I was an assistant project engineer. And I was here for like 3 months. I joined Qualcomm. It was an amazing experience coming in San Diego. It was probably the first time I was in California. And I just basically took hold of a fire hose and learned this test station. You know, there was basically a test system. It was a new device, that new CDMA that was designed to CDMA. And it had vocoders and all kinds of amazing things. And then there was this infrastructure. It was a base station and antennas and cables and a core network behind it and hooks up to the switch network. And so I just kind of like learned that for about 3 months. And then they shipped me off to China to do this trial with probably about 20 or 30 Chinese scientists descending on us to figure out what this new IS-95 CDMA thing was. And so it was amazing. And I just never looked back from college and just kind of got caught up in the whole corporate world of rewards and, you know, people wanting to get things done real fast. And, you know, my maturity and the fact that I had been around for a while really helped. And, you know, that ability to kind of do anything that it took really kind of served me very well in that position. And so they kept me there for 6 months. I was there by myself for like about three, doing data analysis with some of the China team and kind of doing their CDMA report for their standards. And I met Irwin in some meetings.
The founder, right?
The founder, Irwin Jacobs, and Alan Somasi. And there would be a lot of executives who come to China. And since I was the only guy there, I would be one of the guys they would see, and I would kind of help.
So you were living in China for a period of time.
I was living in China basically in Tianjin.
Early 90s too, right?
Early
90s. Different environment.
Oh, it was incredibly different. Yeah, it was a lot of bicycles.
Yeah.
And these small little taxis. And Beijing was pretty amazing. We were just right across the street from Tiananmen Square. Excuse me. And down the street. Yeah, it was an incredible experience. I was in China longer than I was in San Diego. Mm. And so I got back. I had another trial in India. And at the time, Qualcomm was going towards this new commercial space station equipment and doing commercial stuff. And everybody was going off of this trial system, so they really didn't have leaders. And they said, hey, you're probably the most experienced person here. Do you want to lead this whole RTS team, roving test system team? I said, oh, I guess I don't know enough to say no. So sure, why not? Let me give it a shot. And basically, I was like a senior engineer, and I basically was leading this whole team. We did a trial in Russia. We did a trial in Myanmar. We did a trial in Toronto. And we just kind of like all around the world to kind of show and showcase CDMA. So that was like my first introduction into Qualcomm. That was my first big project. And after that, you know, it was basically moving into the CDMA commercial system and doing kind of gravitating towards test, gravitating towards deployment, kind of a system engineer, if you will. I was hired into the hardware department. But then I transitioned into the systems department. And at that point, Qualcomm really didn't have a system test or a test department. It was just a lot of developers and system engineers making things happen. And at that point, they started creating these system test organizations. And I was one of the leads of that organization. It was all matrixed together. And basically, all the way up until 99, that we were talking about earlier, when Qualcomm had this big jump in stock, and they settled with Ericsson, and they had this huge windfall, but they also sold this infrastructure division to Ericsson. So at the time, I had moved into a Qualcomm-only solution to try to put to bed a certain part of the infrastructure that was kind of holding everybody back, and it was this core switch that we had that was also used for Global Store. And I'm probably going into a little
No, that's too good. I'll ask you the dumb guy question in a minute,
please,
because that I am that guy. But you keep going on that because I think we're on a good roll.
Yeah. So when we had this big transition, and I would say 90% of my friends that I worked with were kind of left back in Ericsson, and it was a pretty draconian agreement where Ericsson really wouldn't let anybody have any share of this stock rise. And there was a lot of rumors and a lot of things that maybe I had some inside track and I worked out some special deal, but I really didn't. And I took it personal. And that was a big, big transition to kind of like everything was going glory. And then all of a sudden the reality of, commercial business kind of kicks in and you see the impact of some employees getting this huge windfall and others, kind of like missing out the boat. So that was a big transition for me. And even though I was part of this, big windfall, it was not something I really enjoyed. And kind of like, being a leader at that point and being in charge of a lot of groups, I just didn't know that I wanted to be that leader. Was I still committed? But I kind of, weathered the storm and kind of started doing other things. I worked in corporate R&D and did a bunch of demos and didn't really want to advance like I did before. I mean, I was on this meteoric rise through Qualcomm, just taking over the world. And at that point, the career just kind of like stalled. It's like, hey, there's got to be something a little bit more than this. And so that's when, I kind of started sampling a lot of different types of work. Here I started, doing demos. I switched into technical marketing. I tried project management and program management. And we did this kind of like consultant services. We call it engineering support group. I kind of helped the North America carriers kind of like enhance their data services. This was back in the early 2000s where they really didn't understand how internet worked on a phone. So Qualcomm had this great data service. And this was kind of the classic thing with Qualcomm. They would come up with solutions before they could figure out the problems. And it was always kind of like all about the technology, but never about, okay, how do you take this to market? How do you make some money out of this? And they made a lot of money selling chips, no doubt. And they had a lot of potential. But I think it ended up catching up to them, in the late 2000s, 2010s, where, just selling hardware wasn't quite enough. And they had a lot of fantastic ideas. I mean, Brew was an idea that was before Google in terms of an OS on a smartphone. Didn't really have the right strategy for business. They had another solution called MediaFlow, which was like mobile TV.
I remember that.
Yeah.
We have a mutual friend who worked in that.
We do.
I think Bo James. I remember him showing me this device and I was like, this will never catch on. Who's ever going to watch a video and want to carry it around when they're on the go?
Yeah.
That's why I'm not the wealthy guy sitting here.
Well, that was a big opportunity. Yep. And I think, the big miss was they didn't really recognize how much the licensing costs would be for that content. They kind of felt like, hey, we're going to build it and they will come. But there was a lot of competition between putting it on a phone versus having it in cable versus on the TV. And, there was some liability in terms of the pricing. So a lot of learning that Qualcomm's gone through and never really transitioned it into a service generating revenue that both Google and Apple and Netflix and Amazon and these big power companies, that they were able to get that. And that's where I think Qualcomm's really trying to transition to kind of overcome that concept. So, yeah.
So before I get into your more kind of the specifics of your leadership and you're humble when you talk about not seeing yourself as a leader or wondering what? Because I know in a little bit we're going to talk about the size of the teams you've led and the different projects and for how long you did it and with what level of success. But before we get there, what fundamentally does Qualcomm do for folks who don't know? I, as a non-tech person, it came on my radar probably late 90s, probably right around when the newspaper started reporting on overnight millionaires, quote unquote, right? Mm-hmm. And we know most stuff's not overnight, right? There was a lot of work that led up to that that point.
Sure.
But what does Qualcomm do? I always understood it as being the chip designing and tech licensing folks, but I don't know.
Well, they go about, there's a couple aspects that's really where Qualcomm shines. One is their system level understanding of deploying, you know, the commercial, you know, mobile phones. When you look at mobile phones, it's not just the phones, it's the carriers, it's the ecosystem, it's the standards. So for a long time, their IP really drove the company. And so they just generated a lot of IP. They've got a lot of smart guys. They understand the full system of how that ecosystem works in terms of a mobile phone operating in a carrier network globally, roaming, all the aspects of like having a phone work. And that's where Qualcomm really shines. They really understand the full system. And they haven't, you know, they have a huge amount of people that are just really smart that, you know, like their system engineering is really smart. Their development and drivers, they really feel like they can do everything their own best. But, you know, I think that starts to catch up to you at some point. But they also are a really strong hardware company. So internal to Qualcomm, the hardware is king. That's where they sell money. I mean, they sell hardware chips. They sell RF chips. That's really where their revenue comes. They have licensing for their chipsets. That's another big source. And then they have this IP. They really don't sell software. Mm. I mean, they are now. They're trying to sell software. But as part of your licensing agreement, you get that software for free. Mm. So it's really all about the hardware. That's kind of – and so over the last 10, 15 years, even 20 years, I think, since I joined QCT, which is about 15 years ago, there's been this, okay, we need to kind of understand the impacts of software and how this can really, you know, help drive the company. It's kind of, but that's kind of what they do. So they sell hardware. They understand the system aspect of it. They're really big in driving the standards and all the drivers that impact the ecosystem that this hardware is in. And then they're just amazing at developing hardware chips, SoCs, modems. They're really excellent at modems. RF, they've got a tremendous RF hardware team, transceivers, even power management. I mean, they just look at things. They have a style within the company where information is shared. I mean, it's a real free, open. People kind of like talk about stuff. They have reviews. Now, it doesn't always work smoothly. You know,
It's human beings.
It's human beings. There's turfs and people want things to happen. But at the core, there's always this sense that, you know, things, you know, get reviewed and it's open access. And I think that helps drive the speed of how they get things done, as well as the quality. And being able to solve problems once your customers aren't getting what they need. And they also have a good operations in terms of producing hardware. And you know, their hardware testing team is really strong. And I think as you commercialize, I think the software testing and the system testing is kind of I think the testing aspect is some of the secret sauce in terms of how to make sure these commercial products kind of go out. And that's kind of a common quote within the company. But definitely, and even on the software side, they have a tremendously smart people doing software as well. Go ahead.
So when you and I first met, well, our kids went to school together. And so we'd met kind of casually. But then when we first kind of started to work together is when we were co-board chairs on a board for the San Diego Waldorf School. Mm-hmm. And I remember that you would tell me that you get that you would get, you know, 300, 400, 500 emails a day or some ridiculous number. And you had a team of, I think at that time, 2,000 or 3,000 engineers and various time zones. And you were always jetting off to China and India and all these different places and just working what seemed to be around the clock. Can you talk to us about your philosophy and approach to leadership? How you both as a practical matter, as well as philosophically and kind of the soft skills, how you manage a job like that, where you've got a big sprawling team, multicultural, multilingual, multicontinental, if that's a word, transcontinental, I guess, I don't
global
know.
Team
global, right? Workforce. Global. Yeah.
Well, it's, yeah, I can try. Basically about 15 years ago, when I joined the QCT division, which is his chipset division, that's when the teams got pretty massive. Up until that point, when I was in corporate R&D, it was a media flow. They were reasonably sized teams, 20, 50, maybe up to 100, the line management aspects. And so you kind of knew everybody by person. But as you kind of grow into these massive organizations, it's still the same principles. You really, you've got your circle around you. You really, you know, it's really understanding. I think the one thing that I took from being through Qualcomm is I really wasn't afraid of talking to anybody. You know, I talked with technicians. When I was doing trials, I was in the factory making sure that the factory was meeting their schedules and talking to the planners and talking to the line people and, hey, what are the problems? How can I help you? To talking to Paul Jacobs was working on the vocoder. I'd go and, hey, what is the vocoder? What is a vocoder? And talk to him for a few hours and just figure out what's going on. I didn't even know who he was. Right. And, you know, being able to be in that environment where it is open like that and coming from academia and, you know, just, you know, you don't have those boundaries and hierarchies that are there. So I think one thing is understanding your team and being able to talk to people and listen. And listening is so important and, you know, being sincere. So if they, you know, when you're listening to what they have to say and actively listening and, you know, kind of giving them help when they need help. I think that's one piece. It's like managing down and up and kind of being there for your team. But I think it's also networking around. What is the environment your team's in? Being able to kind of work with the people around you to make sure that the environment your team's working in is meshing with other teams, that you understand what these other teams need for your team or what they need to give to yours, how you work within the organization and what the organization's trying to do. And, you know, that big picture is really important for leads, you know, and it's at every level. It doesn't have to be the whole organization that you know, but, you know, your customers and your vendors, you need to understand that pipeline. And that helps with trying to motivate your team to do what they need to do. And everybody really wants to do a good job. You just have to find those common goals that people can kind of rally behind and, you know, make sure that you're honest and, you know, you try to be sincere. So those are kind of like the principles.
Mm. Well, can you think of one of the biggest challenges that you faced as a leader that might at the time have seemed like an intractable challenge, insurmountable, and how you overcame it? I'm sure you faced a lot of them because you had a long career, but, you know, just thinking about, again, teams that are full of motivated, intelligent people from around the world. You had a lot of engineers from India, from China, from, is there a challenge that stands out for you in your mind, and how did you work through that as a leader?
Well, there's a few key big challenges. I think one of the challenges was, I was working in media flow, and where we were doing these trials and kind of, you know, probably had like 3 or 4 deployments, and we were doing a big deployment with USA. And I went in and talked to my boss and came with an update of how we were planning and all this stuff. And he's like, John, you're doing these five things. I want you to think about 20. You're going to take over the world. I want this to be huge. How can you do that? You need to expand your mind. And my head just, I could feel the top of my head like pop. And it was like, oh my God, that's crazy. But, you know, it took a little time, but it wasn't impossible to think that. It's not like we ever did that much. But it was just like an aha moment. It's just you get kind of contained within what you know and how things are working. And at every once, you kind of be challenged to kind of like expand it out to something bigger. And your mind just gets comfortable in this space. And if you just let it go out, it's just awareness. And it takes a little while. And it kind of hurts at first. But it's not too bad. So same thing with leading like a big team, you know, it's like, okay, there's 300 people, but you know, you have lieutenants, you have captains, you have directors and senior directors, and you work within that circle. You kind of like instill your principles and why those are good. And, you know, and you try to make sure you have reviews and that things are going through. You really have to have people that you trust. People that you respect in those positions. So I would have weekly meetings in India with the lead there, and we just really hit it off. I had a bi-weekly meeting in Germany, and you just ask questions about what's really happening. And these people also had that full centered, you know, they would tell me what was going on, and they knew how to tell me what was important. And we would share priorities and what was happening here, and that would help them understand. And so you just have to trust and delegate to the point, but also verify and make sure that they're, you know, they're doing the right thing and that you're there to help them and you're able to protect them, you know, in terms of, you know, when they get in trouble. So when they trust that you've got their back, and they, you have to have that rapport. And if you've got like somebody who's got their own agenda, you really need to find people around that you can confirm and verify. It's like, okay, well, let's work on that and be sincere with that person and kind of pull them into the fold, but, you know, be able to have some checks and balances. So I don't know, I'm kind of rambling.
No, I think that's some of the pieces that I pulled out of there are certainly this. The balance between delegation, or the tension really between delegation, full blind trust, and trust but verify.
Yeah.
And really depends on the setting and who you're working with. And I think that's something I wrestle with in my leadership too, is there are times when we know, or we think we know, we could be wrong, yeah, as leaders, that we could do it better. Mm-hmm. Right? There's a task and you're like, ah, I could just jump in and do that.
Yeah.
But then the other person doesn't have an opportunity to grow. And they also don't have an opportunity to demonstrate that they may be better at the job than we are.
And it takes time away from you.
That's right. And then you're down a rabbit hole that you didn't even want to get near.
Yeah.
And I think that's – how did you – I mean, now you're in a very peaceful, retired state. But for decades, how did you manage your time – and how did you balance work and home and family?
I do
want
to say, kind of going back, the other big challenge was doing layoffs.
Oh, I didn't want to just throw that out there about laying people off, because I remember many nights we'd meet up for a drink and you look like you'd just been dragged through the car wash.
Those are tough. Those are, you know, that's where you're really trying to be objective for the company. And, you know, the company's got to make money and there's budgets to be made. And when you make layoffs, you know, it's a matter of, sometimes it's a matter of how many people, and a lot of times how much salary they have. And there's a lot of hard trade-offs and, you know, kind of pulling back and the human aspect. And I've had to lay off some very close, wonderful people, you know, and those are super painful. Luckily,
for financial reasons.
For financial reasons. And, you know, maybe some of the decisions weren't quite, you know, could I take them back? Maybe. But in general, I think they've worked out, and, you know, I've been able to kind of work through and help, you know, see these people have successful careers after Qualcomm or after the job layoff. So those are painful, mm-hmm. and there always are. I don't think anyone can say that those are easy to do.
Right. I think if someone who says that's easy is either not telling the truth or they need some extended therapy. So speaking of therapy and self-care and balance and time management, all that, how did you do that? I remember I always used to say, John, you're not going to make it to 60. I'm glad to see. Yeah. I don't want to out you on your age, but I think you made it there. Yeah, yeah. And you're looking good and you're moving forward. Because I knew the hours that you worked and I knew the pressure that you were under and I knew the global aspect of your job, where when you were asleep, someone else was waking up on the other side of the world and they may have questions. You wake up and your questions are there waiting for you. How did you do it all?
Well, I mean, it's kind of like a frog in a boiling water, you know, kind of aspect where you really just don't know. It's also this kind of how much you can do and you don't really want to think of what you can't do. You're always thinking what you can. A lot of responsibility. I mean, it was never 3,000 people, but it was more like 1,500, maybe 2,000.
Wow. It's a lot.
It's still a lot.
It's still a mid-sized town in the Midwest.
You feel this responsibility to these people, and there's a little bit of pressure. You want to like succeed, and a lot of these things really make a difference. I mean, and the email, you just work out ways to filter and keywords that you search through, and you can kind of tell what's important and what isn't. You kind of keep your tabs on, you know, basically you have good project schedules, you have good, you know, to-dos. Never really was good at setting up to-do actions, but I always kind of drove things through email and scheduling meetings and had good administrators that would kind of like take care of me. And you know, you just kind of, there's a lot of late hours, a lot of, you know, and you can't really work that late unless you kind of like it.
Yeah.
So in some ways it was stressful, but in other ways it was rewarding. So, and you know, you kind of get caught up, and the one thing at Qualcomm is everybody's kind of doing it.
Right.
So is this kind of like group pressure, if you will? And you don't really think about it, but when your team's working really hard and they're working over the weekends, you're thinking, well, I'm one of my leadership principles is lead by example and make sure. And there's a little bit of catch 22 because you don't want to be working late because then that pulls your team in. But
right.
There's definitely, you know, you never know when you should stop and so, or how you pull back. And I think with COVID, it really did kind of calm everybody down a little bit at Qualcomm, where, you know, people kind of realize that there's a little bit of a health risk here and mental risk. So things have kind of calmed down a little bit, I think, but there's still this kind of peer pressure that happens. And I don't know, you kind of just get used to it. I almost kind of, now that I am retired, I almost miss it in a way. It's just like, hey, there's not, you know, I don't have this big long list of email to look at. It's not bad. It's definitely a fun challenge to kind of get used to. It's not too bad, but I don't know. It was just kind of being connected and understanding what's going on and kind of being aware of what the priorities were and really having a good sense of prioritization. That really, really helped, like what needed to get done, listening to your team. Yeah. And it wasn't any like special skills or calendaring or some app that I used. It was just kind of brute force and getting used to it. It was really driven by email a lot, actually. And understanding who people were. We have a Photo PH. It's basically a library of all the employees. And in this library, there's all the email lists that they attend. So you can go and search anybody in the Qualcomm. You can find out who they line report to. But if you go through their email lists, you kind of get a little picture of what they are, or some of their, you know, who which teams they're on, what they're working on. I really miss that PH because it really told me a lot. It would help me kind of navigate the whole organization and figure out who to go and who's working on what. And even with people I knew, I could kind of catch up with them just by looking at their profile.
So you also had pretty amazing support at home.
Yes, I did. Yeah.
And so that's important, right?
Because it is.
Because you know that that's being taken care of while you're working late hours.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing. That's one of the challenges.
And now you're in her hair all the time, so she's...
Not too bad.
Not too much?
Not too bad. She's busy.
Okay.
She's going through acupuncture school. Niku.
Yeah.
She's an amazing woman. You know, it's amazing when things don't work or you start feeling like, oh, there's tension. That's something you really got to get settled because it's such an anchor. To be able to do what I was doing at Qualcomm. I mean, she's the reason I was able to, I mean, up until the time I got married and started dating Niku, things were just topsy-turvy and I wasn't really taking care of myself. And it was kind of ragged, but you know, it's amazing having her, and she's just such a supporting health nut, just really all about, you know, and she really takes the family so seriously, and she nurtures the kids and she nurtures me, and it's just, yeah, what a wonderful person.
Yeah.
You got to have that.
Yeah,
that
you
does
do.
Help.
You definitely lucked
it's
out.
It's kind of a secret sauce.
Nah, you lucked out. So I want to pivot a little bit. We touched on our service on the Waldorf School board as co-chair. I think
exactly. Neither
of us was too much into being the chair, and then we talked each other into co-chair. And,
yeah, exactly.
But you chose the Waldorf School for all your children, for their like preschool through eighth grade education.
Grade.
So
yeah, they all went
why Waldorf education?
Well, coming from Madison, Wisconsin, kind of the Berkeley of the Midwest or Berkeley of the Big Ten, you know, I was kind of a left-leaning. I'd always kind of on the side, and being in dance and having this kind of spiritual connection to, and really, we just lucked into it. I mean, Niku found it. She was looking at Montessori and Waldorf, and she basically kind of did the legwork. And when I found out about it, I'm like, wow, this really makes sense. I didn't really know too much about Steiner and the whole foundation behind it at that point. I don't know that that would have scared me away, but I just liked the social aspect that it brought to the children and how it grounded and how they looked at them in a wholesome, whole, full approach to childhood and, you know, immersive, and how they interact with this class and the rhythms that they induce and the well-rounded education of, you know, rhythmy and handwork and orchestra and, yeah, math and physics could, or, you know, science could be a little bit beefier, especially in the grades. But, you know, in terms of their creating their own workbooks and the amount of richness and the mythical stories and how they bring that through the curriculum, I've really enjoyed. And the community around, I mean, the people that you find within Waldorf and, you know, they... relationships I've had with other parents at Waldorf have been very rich, and they've also kind of carried me through this crazy high-tech company world. It's always been kind of
a counterbalance.
I've always had counterbalances when I was in out throughout my whole life, and
dance and science lab.
Exactly. And so Waldorf kind of provided that cultural counterbalance to the high-tech world. Yeah,
it was interesting. I'm glad you mentioned that counterbalance piece, because for someone who's in a high tech career and I think several of your children are in the math and science orientation in college now, and or headed into college. I know that's been one of the questions I've had about the Waldorf school, even in regards to my own daughter and her journey there. And there were a lot of wonderful things that came out of it, but the math piece was a weakness. And so it's interesting to see, even despite that, I think you would put your kids in again if you had it. I think I would.
Yeah. We did some tutoring, kind of help them through the math, and they've caught up during. One of them's in math major. Right. The other one's becoming a lawyer. And
oh, okay. That's right.
One's still a junior. But yeah, I think, and high school, junior in high school.
Yeah.
So I think I would definitely put my kids back through Waldorf. I think there's definitely a capacity within Waldorf to teach math. Mm-hmm. I did a high school training and was focused on math and physics.
I remember that.
Back before I joined QCT, it was like a summer up in Sacramento. You had your midlife crisis? I guess you could call
that. Midlife career crisis?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, I was thinking about being a teacher, maybe holding up. And then we bought a house and that kind of went to the wayside.
The numbers didn't work
out.
That's
probably when we met. Probably.
Probably right around there. Because I thought, who is this dude? Like, what? Qualcomm to, what? Okay, yeah, well, we'll
what
see.
What is that all about? But I think it definitely has the capacity. And I think I met some really amazing math teachers through that experience, if you will. I think it's just kind of like how the school kind of handles it. And they try. It's just, you know, it's definitely tough. But yeah, I think it's something that's easily overlooked.
I'm going to ask the question that my daughter has told me to stop asking because she's my editor and also unsolicited commentator. She gives me feedback in real time almost.
I'm sure she does.
The AI question.
Ah.
Do you think that we're going to get to a point where AI will replace – so let's just say you had 1,500 people on a team in the height of the QTC work. Are we going to get to a point where AI does a lot of that work instead of individual humans?
Well, I think AI can really enhance how we do that work. The way I look at AI is it basically allows us to do innovation to do more work. So yeah, I think AI might be able to take a lot of the mundane aspects of even doing software development, even doing any kind of, you know, large language model kind of thing, coming up with, you know, doing text, doing translations, doing, there's a lot of aspects that can be enhanced with AI. But I also think it allows us to expand what it is that we can work in. And really innovate in terms of areas that we can grow. So I think we're in store for a massive, you know, evolution of what we can do with chips and how systems can come together. I mean, right now there's multiple chips that are getting combined. Now they're stacking chips together. They're really looking at, you know, Murphy's Law is kind of coming to, you know, we're getting close to the edge here. But, you know, now we're doing 3D chips and there's a lot of other aspects that are going to be enhancing and kind of packing this in pretty soon. Maybe we'll have cubes of chips. It won't be just a single or multiple layers. It'll be stacked on top of each other. So I think the complexity is going to require people to kind of design those. And I think AI will kind of like be our help to help design those. So I think the surface area is going to grow bigger, but yeah, I think in terms of today, I think the jobs that we have, it's definitely going to be going to AI. And I think AI is going to help us do those so that we can do more. I really look at it as an opportunity as opposed to something that's going to be taking jobs away, personally.
It's fascinating to see. I think I've been playing around just with ChatGPT version 4 or whatever for the last year or so, and even to see the advances that it's made, and then also the limitations in terms of – I was laughing because the platform that we upload this podcast, we upload it to this platform, and from there it goes to Spotify and Apple and whatever. So it's like a feed.
Yeah.
And we put the show notes in there and everything. And so there's an AI option. You can click AI, and AI will actually enhance the sound quality, but also it writes show notes for you based on the content. Mm-hmm. So you don't, you know, if you're rushed for time or whatever, I like to write, you know, and I have a couple of folks helping me, and we like to just listen to the episode and write it. But I noticed one recently that was up in there, and I thought, there's no way I would say that. It was, it's good, but yeah, it just doesn't sound like me and doesn't sound like anyone else on the team. Uh-huh. And it was because it was AI. It was just a little bit too
edgy, or
no, it was more a little bit too heavy on the adverbs and adjectives, right? Just like almost like writing ad copy for something like late night TV ads for something like one of those as seen on TV commercials, like the most amazing thing. Just put this belt on. You'll learn, you'll lose 20% of your body fat before you wake up in the morning. Do it right now. And if you order now, you'll get a free carrying case, that kind of thing. And so it was the show notes for that. And I was laughing, but maybe in a year it might be indistinguishable from our style of writing for our team, right? Maybe it's learned that, I don't know.
Yeah,
it's interesting even to think about analyzing big data sets. I've recently been playing around with, you know, taking a spreadsheet, having AI analyze and say, give me top three data patterns that are in this spreadsheet. You know how long that takes me?
Yeah,
a long time. It takes this thing 3 seconds.
Yeah.
So I think in those areas, you know, and of course, we're going to need to go back and verify. And I had a guest on here last calendar year, and I'd gone on in advance, and I said, list the top most cited articles that this guy wrote. He was a college professor. Give me the top 10 most cited articles that he wrote. He gives me top 10s. I have them ready. And so before the interview, I say, hey, can I ask you, did you write these? And he's like, no, that one sounds like something I wrote, but I never wrote it with this co-author. So it's because it was, in some ways, it was almost creating this thing out of thin air. The format was perfect, right? So it looked really official.
It looked.
But the facts were still squishy.
Yeah.
So I think the thinking person, the critical thinker, is going to wade through this and go, okay, it can be a powerful tool over here, and over here it's just not ready yet. But, you know, we've had it around a long time. If you have a self-driving car or you have Alexa or Siri, you've been using it for years.
AI is amazing. Yeah, it has been for a while.
Yeah.
I was talking to somebody who was working in AI back in 95. Yeah. He was a graduate student, and, you know, I'm like, whoa, you were in AI? Yeah, I was back then.
Yeah,
I
mean, now everybody wants to.
No, it's just taking off.
It's taking off everywhere.
It's amazing.
Yeah. How can schools, K-12, prepare students for a career like yours?
Schools in K-12.
Like in my line of work, how can we at least position students to be able to have the opportunities based on a lot of hard work that you put in and study, but position students so that they could conceivably end up where you are?
I think it's executive management. I think as you get into a company, you know, I was like a system engineer, a test engineer, you could say, but it was somebody that really, you know, it was basically, you know, I think it's the skill set to kind of do what it takes. I don't know how to really define it, but it's being open to, it's more like a skill set of getting things done and having these fundamentals. I mean, you need to have, you know, whether I did electrical engineering or aeronautical engineering, I could have done physics. It probably would have been a little tougher to get this job, but, you know, with Qualcomm, just being, you know, an intelligent person and being able to, you know, having the desire to get things done, that really helps. And then as you get into a business and you want to be a leader, I mean, if you're saying, how do I lead like 1,200, 1,500 people. How do I get into it? Not all companies, it's easy to do that.
And not all of them need that.
And not many need that, right? So I think it's, you know, either being a software developer, computer science, electrical engineering. Once you get into an engineering field, that's really when you get this business training. I mean, and figuring out how to lead. So from K to 12, it's just kind of being good at the fundamentals, you know, kind of being open to what's happening in the world, understanding the systems or how things connect together, and how things operate, you know, getting a little exposure to what, you know, academics. I mean, when I look at my career, it was getting exposure to all these different things, these anchor points where all of a sudden academics, you know, the university opened up. All of a sudden, you know, math, where I had an opportunity to go see a company. And when you see a company, ask questions like, okay, who's in charge? What are the outputs? Who's your customer? How do you get this done? I think those are the kind of questions that demystify
right.
these industries and it just kind of like opens your eyes that there are these positions out there, and there's multiple ways to get there. It's just, as you get to a certain point of leadership, you know, you have to have a core skill set that helps you kind of manage these people around you. But that management capability is something that, you know, you can learn it, but you know, there's an empathy component, there's a listening component, there's a awareness of your surroundings and networking, being able to network around. There's, you know, kind of asking questions and not being afraid to, you know, really listen for the answers. There's a lot of aspects to. So K to 12, I say that, you know, I think being in technology, just understanding that there's all these trees that you can kind of follow. You can be high tech. You can be an individual contributor. You can work on patents. You can really, you know, be a real technical contributor. Or you can be like an executive leader and make sure that things get done, that things get commercialized, they go to market. And I tell you, there's a lot of branches in between those two, even, of trying to do something within the high tech field. That makes sense.
That's great. Yeah, it does make sense. And so, as much the soft skills as it is the hard skills.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, no matter what the industry is, right?
Exactly.
So I have two more questions for you. You've been very generous with your time. What would the 60-year-old you say to your 25-year-old self? Other than, I don't think the dance is going to become a long-term career.
Oh, no. I would say enjoy the heck out of that dance. I mean, when I was dancing, I mean, that just basically, once I was 25, I was like, my life is so great. Everything can go downhill. It's fine. I've reached my peak. I'll be happy if I get to 40. I don't even want to live past 40.
Right.
Everything is gravy or change. So I would just tell my 25-year-old just not to be so emotional, to try to calm down on women and try not to feel like, you know, just relax and keep that fire and just try to get things done and help people. I mean, that's kind of what I would hope to tell that person. But I don't know if he would listen.
Yeah, no, probably not. That's probably youth is wasted on I don't know. My mom has some youth saying about if youth should and old age could or something, but it's a proverbial thing. So but yeah, the things we wish we knew. And if we'd known them then, we wouldn't have paid attention.
Exactly.
So the last question, before I get to the last question, I want to see if there's anything you'd like to add that's been kicking around in your head before we wrap for today with my last question.
Peppering around a bunch of topics. Yeah.
That's how these go. Yeah. This is a reflection of my brain.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not
your
linear.
Your brain or my brain?
Or both of our brains. Yeah. There's nothing linear going on here.
Yeah, I don't feel anything I'm missing. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there's a bunch of things I'd like to, you know, say hi to a bunch of friends.
Yeah, there we go. My tens things. And tens of listeners out there. We have our friends, and some of them, it may actually get to them because we have mutual friends who I think listen to this. So the last question is, you're given the opportunity to design a billboard on the side of the 5 freeway. And remember, people are driving by it 70 miles an hour, and it's just one billboard. It's not pages and pages of text. But what does John Detra's billboard say about the message that he wants to get out there to the world? Something about your life, something about your beliefs, something about your work, something about your family, your dreams.
This is one of those things you don't want to think too hard about.
You don't. You just got to. There's two groups of people who do, some people immediately go, oh, it would say this. Some people are like, it would have an image of this. And I'm going, I think you cheated on this. You heard it somewhere.
Yeah.
Other people, it takes them a while. And in both of those paths,
I could have cheated and I forgot. Because it's not the first time I've heard the question, but I was going to think about it. And even when I heard it, I thought about it a little bit. And I thought, oh, yeah. I don't know. I mean, the world is just so crazy right now. I mean, if there's anything to try to get people to just work together, I mean, it just seems like something so simple. Everybody, I know there's all these divisions, but at the ground roots, everybody wants to do what's right. And you know, it's just, and I don't know, it's not, I don't want it to look like some religious kind of like church thing, but gosh, that just would be so, you know, just some kind of image to just get along and give each other a chance. And, you know, just, I tell you, that's something I'd like to get out to the world personally, just to, you know, I'm just so tired of all this division and, you know, being a leader and seeing all these different personalities and, you know, being at a company like Qualcomm and getting all these personalities to work and finding those common grounds. It's possible.
I mean, it is possible.
So many cultures at Qualcomm and we're able to make it work. I mean, there's so many different right and left rings. And, you know, if you've got these common goals, it's just, you know, and it's not just one side or the other. It's really, so yeah, that would probably be it.
Yeah. Well, thank you, John. I think that's an apropos place to wrap for today. And I really wanted to thank you for coming in and chatting. And now I've covered two of my very dear friends who both were former Qualcomm employees, you and Bo James. Mm-hmm. And so I know we've got a little head-to-head competition going on between the two of you for this podcast. But in all seriousness, it was a pleasure to chat with you and learn some new things about your life that I didn't know. So thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you, Dave.
Thank you for listening to the Superintendent's Hangout. You can follow me on Twitter at DVS1970. Please be sure to share this show with friends and family on social media and in the real world. Thank you to Brad Bacayal for editing and production assistance, and to Tina Royster for scheduling and logistics. Thanks for hanging out and have a great day.